From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Malaysia says man with stolen passport was an asylum seeker. Journalist gunned down in Afghan capital. U.S. wants India to resolve nuclear civil liability law. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Police in Malaysia have identified a 19-year-old Iranian man as one of two passengers on Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 traveling on stolen passports. But they say there is no indication the man had links to terrorism. Bill Ide reports from Beijing that searchers still have found no evidence of where the plane went down.
Malaysian authorities say they believe 19-year-old Iranian Pariya Noor Mohammad Mirdad was seeking asylum in Germany. Malaysian Police Chief Khalid Abu Bakar spoke to reporters in Kuala Lumpur.
If you ask me, how do I know that he wants to migrate to Germany? Because we are in contact with his mother. Okay? His mother is expecting him to arrive in Frankfurt. When he doesn't arrive, he contacted us here. And then that's why we knew that he's the one.
Khalid says the man's mother knew he was traveling on a stolen passport. He did not comment on the identity of the other passenger also traveling with stolen documents. Meanwhile, an extensive review of all of those on board continues. Khalid says authorities are looking into four possible scenarios in connection with the plane's disappearance: hijacking, sabotage, personal disputes, and the psychological condition of all of those on board.
There may be somebody there on the flight who has bought huge sums of insurance, who wants the family to gain from it. Or somebody who has owed somebody so much money and.
I think that's a genuine possibility.
Yeah, we are looking into all possibilities, I say.
As relatives and friends of passengers wait for word on the fate of the flight in the Malaysian capital and in Beijing, many were holding on to hope. The wife of Malaysia's prime minister visited with families in the Malaysian capital. In Beijing, families were anxious for any sign of progress, says one woman surnamed Wang, a daughter of one of the missing passengers. Wang says that for family members who lost contact with their relatives, the most pressing issue is to find out where they are and what happened. She says that if the search and rescue is not yielding any results, they hope that authorities increase their efforts into the investigation of the possibility the plane was hijacked. As many hoped for the best, they were also prepared for the worst. Salamat is the father of flight MH370 passenger Maud Karul Amri. He says, "We hope to see whether he is alive and in good condition, or whatever the outcome, we accept." Authorities from China have handed over photos of all 153 Chinese nationals on board the flight. China is stepping up its efforts to help aid in the search for the missing plane as search efforts pushed into its fourth day. Beijing has redeployed satellites to help in the search for the Boeing 77 jet that vanished from radar screens early Saturday morning. Nine countries have joined the search effort, which once again was expanded on land and sea Tuesday. Search efforts are focusing on waters off the east and west of the Malaysian Peninsula. U.S. naval vessels have joined the search in the Gulf of Thailand, and a P-3C Orion anti-submarine and surveillance aircraft is aiding the search over waters off the west of Malaysia, in the northern Straits of Malacca and the Andaman Sea. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
With no official information as to why Malaysia Airlines MH370 disappeared en route to Beijing, and many conflicting stories and ideas, it is impossible to know right now what happened to the plane. Still, everyone has an opinion on this mysterious event. What do you think? You may join our poll found at voanews.com/daybreakasia to register your thoughts. Normally, we unveil the final results on our Monday morning program, but this week we'll give you a running total to see how this is trending. So far, more than 38% feel terrorism is involved, while almost 25% think mechanical failure is to blame. 10% have voted for human error, and about 4% say weather played a factor. That would include darkness because it was an overnight flight. But a large number, 23%, just don't know based on what we do know so far. Again, our poll is at voanews.com/daybreakasia. It's unscientific, but an interesting reflection of what you and others in our audience are thinking. A journalist of Swedish and British nationality was gunned down in broad daylight on the streets of Kabul Tuesday. VOA's Sharon Bain reports on increasing violence in the Afghan capital in the approach to presidential elections on April 5th.
Niels Horner had been in Kabul only a few days when he was shot in the head and killed. An experienced radio reporter, he was walking with his interpreter down a heavily guarded street when two men came up to him. One drew a gun and shot Horner in the head. The Taliban denied responsibility for the daylight killing, underlining growing insecurity in the capital and the multiple threats that exist in the country beyond that hardline militant group. Mujib Kalwatgar, head of an organization that supports independent media in Afghanistan, says he expects more attacks against journalists as the April 5 presidential elections get closer.
We will be witnessing more threats and violences against journalists. This was because the government of Afghanistan wants to put more pressure on media, and also the insecurity increasing is something that says for us that the threats and violences against journalists raise day by day.
The Taliban have said they will kill anyone who takes part in the April 5th ballot. Kalwatgar said three journalists have been killed since the start of the year, and more than 10 others have been physically or verbally harassed. The Swedish embassy confirmed Horner's death. The killing took place not far from a Lebanese restaurant bombed by the Taliban in January, killing 21 people. 13 were foreigners. Jan Kubisch, head of the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, swiftly condemned the killing of a media worker, adding his deep concern for all civilians targeted by violence. In a statement, Kubisch called on the authorities to bring the perpetrators to justice. Horner was in the heavily guarded Akbar Khan diplomatic area of Kabul when he was shot. His organization said he was an experienced journalist who worked in Iraq and Egypt as well as Afghanistan. Witnesses said the gunman shot Horner in the head. The reporter collapsed in a pool of blood. He was taken to a hospital but was dead on arrival. Swedish radio said it was one of the worst days in the organization's history. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Beijing is stepping up a campaign for Chinese citizens in the world to highlight what it sees as Japan's history of aggression and war crimes against China. In a series of moves since January, China declared two Remembrance Days related to its 20th century conflict with Japan. One of the national days commemorates the victims of the Nanjing Massacre launched by Japanese forces in 1937, while the other marks the victory of Allied powers over Japan in 1945. So what impact is this Chinese campaign having on the public? Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at the University of California in Irvine, shared his view with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin.
Well, young people are ones who have been particularly exposed to a kind of ramped-up version of patriotic education that began after 89 in particular. And so they are very exposed. And there's a lot of playing on television of films that show Japanese troops behaving horribly in China and brave Chinese standing up against them. So fewer and fewer people are actually remembering those events, but many more people have a kind of intense, what's sometimes called prosthetic memory of it, a kind of secondhand memory because they've seen so many images on TV and stuff. And I think the last thing that's important to keep in mind about all this is the Communist Party is doubling down on certain kinds of patriotic stories because some of the other stories they tell about why they deserve to rule are having less and less purchase. Earlier in the history of the Communist Party, in its control of China, it could tell a story that once we came into power, wealth was more equally distributed than it had been in the past, and officials became less corrupt than they had been in the past. Well, now China is an incredibly unequal land in terms of wealth and poverty, and everybody knows that. And there's a lot of corruption within the official class, and everybody knows that, too. So one of the stories that is left to tell is it wasn't until we came into power that China was able to stand up tough in the world. And it wasn't until we came into power that that foreigners stopped being able to have unfair advantages in our country. So they're kind of doubling down on these kinds of things in the last 20 years. And so that means that a young generation has been particularly exposed to that kind of publicity drives, propaganda drives. And so it does have some kind of effect.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom is also co-author of the book China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know, which has previously been featured right here on Daybreak Asia. The Chinese government has been using a variety of tools to tell the story of its defiance of Japanese aggression, from domestic TV programs and news publications to newspaper articles written by Chinese diplomats for an overseas audience. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin also spoke with Jeremy Goldkorn, director of the Danway Media Research Service in Beijing, and asked him to assess the significance of those steps.
It's quite difficult to tell. I mean, the Chinese government's external propaganda of one kind or another tends to be rather wooden and not particularly effective on people outside of China. But as I said, TV programs, documentaries about what they call in China the anti-Japanese war have long been a staple of Chinese television. And I don't know exactly, you know, if they're double this year what they were last year or what the numbers are. So, I mean, there are always programs about the anti-Japanese war on TV. I think there seem to be a few more in recent years. They tend to be either drama series or historical documentaries, and they would cover the range of Japanese activities and atrocities from the Nanjing Massacre, where hundreds and hundreds and thousands of ordinary citizens in the city of Nanjing were massacred, raped, and tortured, to things like the Japanese camp in northeast China, where they performed experiments on Chinese citizens, including infecting them with bubonic plague and then freezing them and drowning them and trying to figure out the limits of human endurance through these atrocities. So, you know, these type of documentaries will concern this type of thing. And to a populace that, you know, already has a memory, a collective memory of these events, which is reinforced through the education system and reinforced through TV and films, these events remain very real, and as a result of anti-Japanese feeling is something that is very real in China.
Well, how nationalistic is sentiment generally? Do you find that some Chinese like what they hear from the government propaganda machine, or that some people want to hear more of that or less? Or is there a whole range of opinion?
It very much depends on which issue you're talking about. In the case of attitudes towards Japan, popular reactions on social media and on the streets tend to very much fall in line with the government, and sometimes are more extreme. You sometimes get reactions where people feel that, you know, the government is too weak, that if the government was stronger, they could, you know, just, you know, take over the Diaoyu Islands and, you know, ensure that the facts on the ground made it China's rather than having to debate with the Japanese. But generally speaking, attitudes are very much in line with the government's.
Jeremy Goldkorn is the director of Danway, a website and research firm that tracks Chinese media and internet. He spoke with Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin. On a visit to India, the U.S. Energy Secretary has said that India needs to resolve a contentious civil nuclear liability law, which is hampering investment in the country's fast-growing nuclear energy sector. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, his visit is part of efforts to pick up a dialogue interrupted by a recent diplomatic dispute.
After holding talks with Indian officials on energy issues in New Delhi on Tuesday, American Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz said that India needs to align its nuclear liability law with an international convention on compensation, which is due to come into force this year.
Resolving this convention is important for all companies, including Indian companies, and that in turn will be resolving that is an enabler to reach the goals of nuclear power as a major part of the clean energy future.
A landmark 2008 agreement with the U.S. led to the lifting of a decades-long ban on international nuclear trade with India. It was expected to help India ramp up nuclear power generation. However, a stringent liability clause adopted under pressure from activists and the opposition has hampered those efforts. Foreign companies are concerned that this law disproportionately burdens suppliers of nuclear equipment with payments in case of an accident. And American companies are disgruntled that more than 5 years after the U.S. facilitated the deal, they have not reaped the benefits they had hoped for. The only deal India has signed with an American company is a preliminary contract with Westinghouse Electric. The issue is clouding bilateral ties. But the Indian official who led the energy dialogue, Montek Singh Ahluwalia, is optimistic that a solution can be found.
It is true that it's not only the United States that has raised this issue. Other partners with whom we want to pursue nuclear cooperation have similar concerns. And what I said was that we are hopeful that within, I don't like the use of the term dilute, within the existing framework of the Civil Nuclear Liability Act, it should be possible to resolve these problems. And this would be relevant not just for U.S. suppliers, it would be relevant for French suppliers, Canadian suppliers, Russian suppliers, and also Indian suppliers.
Moniz will hold more talks in Mumbai on Wednesday on the nuclear energy issue. The energy dialogue is important as the U.S. seeks to expand its market for renewable energy technologies. India, which suffers from massive power shortages, has huge potential. However, nuclear energy is not the only area where the two countries have differences. They have also clashed over India's expanding solar energy market. The U.S. complains that India is discriminating against American suppliers by mandating domestic content requirements for solar suppliers and has taken the dispute to the World Trade Organization. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
In the U.S. state of California, a political battle is underway over a proposed amendment to a state law called Proposition 209. That bans what has come to be known as affirmative action, a policy of providing special opportunities for and favoring members of a disadvantaged group who suffer discrimination. The amendment is called SCA, or Senate Constitutional Amendment 5. It would, in essence, reinstate affirmative action as it applies to education in California's system of state colleges and universities. One of the organizations supporting the amendment is the California Teachers Association. It represents about 90% of California teachers who teach grades kindergarten through 12th grade. The CTA spokesman is Mike Mislinski, who spoke with VOA's Ira Melman.
We believe in affirmative action. We believe affirmative action programs promote an equitable society. We believe that the makeup of students who are admitted to our state university system should reflect the very diverse population of California at large. And that has been some of the strong concerns that led to this new legislation, that indeed, while we are seeing in our high schools that our more ethnic minority students are graduating, we are not seeing the same kind of numbers in terms of minorities being admitted to our top college systems in California, which are referred to as the University of California system. It's a world-renowned system. And then we have the California State University system, which is another public university system in our state. So that's what's bringing this on. That's the underlying cause for this and need for this type of, in essence, referendum. This would go on our ballot and the voters would decide.
Many members of the Asian American community in California are rallying against this amendment, saying that it is unfair that many of them work hard, achieve more than most other people. What do you say to them who are saying that, you know, we are performing better. We have better test scores, so that's the way it should be. There shouldn't be any kind of advantage for somebody else.
This law, if approved by voters, does not set up any specific quotas or official affirmative action programs. So perhaps some of that that concern is misplaced. There would be no formal quota system, no formal affirmative action program.
But is there a possibility that a Latino or an African-American student with lower scores than an Asian-American student might be admitted over the Asian-American student in any way, shape, or form?
You know, I really can't speculate on that. I mean, that would be speculation. This is up to the university officials to, if this is approved and does become law, and it has a ways to go before it even gets on the ballot, it would be up to them to follow the law and interpret the law.
A large group of Californians who oppose the law is a good number of the state's populous Asian American community. They represent 38% of California's public college student population and account for 45% of the freshman class. That's more than double their share of California's population. They fear SCA 5 and its return to affirmative action would greatly reduce their numbers in California schools. Our Ira Melman spoke with W.B. Wu, the former lieutenant governor of the state of Delaware and the president of the 80-20 Political Action Committee. Wu says it is the largest Asian American political action committee in the United States.
The SCA 5, alternatively called by someone who's very good at it, Skin Color Act, Five basically says, hey, when universities in California, which are prohibited from using race as a factor in admitting students because of Proposition 209, it should be abolished. We should go back to the standard of using skin color to decide who should be admitted as one of the criteria, but it's a powerful usage in some states.
Well, the Asian American community, not only in California, but throughout the entire country, could be considered by some to be people of color, to be a minority, although a growing minority. Why isn't the Asian American community in line with affirmative action?
Well, it is because we don't believe that the color of the skin, just like Dr. Martin Luther King said, should be a factor. It should be the content of character that matters. So we work hard, we study hard, and we believe that in spite of our skin color, we can gradually excel without using color as a criteria. Imagine how unfair it is to the Caucasian people. Why should a darker color skin be used as an advantageous factor? Well, maybe way back in 1965, when civil rights first got started, some kind of affirmative action, not in employment, in promotion, in college admissions, should be used because it was such a new idea. All the color people, you know, the blacks, the Hispanics, the Asian Americans were all really discriminated against. But five decades later, are we still using this? Come on, think about it.
SCA 5 has passed the California State Senate, but pressure brought on by opponents, including protests by Asian Americans, have slowed the process of passage in the state assembly. That would be needed to put the amendment on the November voting ballot. We'll continue to follow the story right here on Daybreak Asia and on our program page at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. Please stay tuned for the latest world news. It's next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets